I had tried to be an emergency medicine physician when I was an internist, and I was a little bit better than that rather than being a good internist. And so they threw me at internal medicine, and I chose a specialty where you have to know hardly anything to be an expert, which is why I've done okay. So if you haven't taken your boards, this is the only thing you need to know.
Well, who else could that be but Corey Slovis? Yes, Corey Slovis. He's from Tennessee. He's tall, he's dark, he's handsome. He's speaking at AAEM 2010. Corey Slovis, who was Speaker of the Year last year at Essentials of Emergency Medicine. Corey Slovis, a man who I, and I'm not afraid to say it, am deeply, deeply in love with.
In emergency medicine, ABCs, airway, breathing, cardiovascular stability, every time, every patient, unless there's a DNR, an advanced directive. If a patient has alterations in mental status, we consider or give naloxone, a pure narcotic antagonist, find out the patient's glucose, and if they're cachectic or malnourished, do they need thiamine? Finally, the beauty of our specialty. There are only five causes, five steps, five reasons for anything and everything. And when there isn't, you just drop one or two or you subdivide, and it comes out to five. So on that note, I want to do some diseases that you all know a lot about, but I want to try to make some teaching points, and hopefully at the end of this 45 or 50 more minutes, you take home at least 5 points. On that, let me begin. As far as shortness of breath, there are only five causes. The heart, cardiac, the lung, pulmonary, in your head, whether it be anxiety, perhaps you're so excited already listening to me, or metabolic acidosis. It's neuromuscular. Any one of the neuromuscular diseases causing pulmonary weakness, or maybe just a flail chest or multiple broken ribs. And then finally, abnormal blood. Is the patient hypoxic, anemic? Could they have carbon monoxide on board? Five causes. Similarly, I'm going to be talking about wheezing. And there are five causes of wheezing, and only five. Reactive airway disease. And I shove a bunch in there, you know, like COPD, asthma, bronchiolitis. All that wheezes is not asthma. Is it heart failure? New onset wheezing. Be careful. In the elderly, think about heart failure. In someone younger or who has any of the Virchow's risk factors, could it be a PE, a smaller one? And then finally, could it be physical, a pneumothorax, or could it be a mass? And I take some editorial liberties to make it into just five. And that is a mass you could see with your eye, a peanut, maybe more unilateral wheezing, or something you see with your eye on a chest x-ray or a CT scan, an infiltrate or a tumor. So those are my five causes of wheezing, my five causes of shortness of breath. Otitis media is one of the best diseases around. I can diagnose it without even evaluating a child. I can do asthma too, wheezing, asthma. It doesn't mean it's right, and it can be really dangerous. So all that wheezes is not asthma.
All right, he's moving along quite nicely here, and he's going to talk about the first cause of wheezing. The first cause of wheezing here, anaphylaxis. We've talked about this before. Let's do a little Corey Slovis summary, because nobody is simpler than Corey Slovis. Nobody. I'm convinced of it.
The first disease I want to talk about as far as wheezing is anaphylaxis, an acute systemic allergic reaction. And here are the classic five symptoms, but I don't think that those are important to know. I think it's much more important to know how people with anaphylaxis present to us in the emergency department. And the single most common presentation as far as symptomatology is not wheezing, but in fact it's skin manifestations, either a little bit more or a little bit less, but just about 9 out of 10 or more patients will have a erythematous rash, a urticarial rash. They will just have some skin manifestation. Don't depend just on wheezing, because up to 4 out of 10 patients will not present with it. It is a systemic reaction. If you get stung by a bee and it gets red and it hurts, it's called a bee sting. You get stung by a bee and you get red, all of you or much of you, that's anaphylaxis, a systemic reaction. Those are the big five. You know, I memorized that for the boards and stuff. But we don't routinely see that many patients with in-hospital anaphylaxis. We mostly see people coming to the emergency department with an allergic reaction. And I was surprised But the number one cause is not a sting. It's not food. The number one cause in studies is unknown cause. The exact etiology of why the person had the acute allergic reaction and anaphylaxis is unclear. And also, please note that number five, there is mixed and multiple etiologies. The real big three are food, medications, and exercise.
Food, medication, exercise are the three big causes of anaphylaxis. Food, medication, exercise.
And so if you've been walking around Las Vegas a lot, there are a huge number of people here for a convention, and it's people that share, they have exercise-induced anaphylaxis, and they're unable to exercise at all. You'll see them all around. They're huge. But it is voluntary. They are fearful of anaphylaxis from exercise and avoid it at all costs. And if you read Nature Science this week, apparently a high-fat diet is also protective, and they've combined those two. Okay, anaphylaxis, big giant study, one of the largest studies done, 25 years. And look, when they looked at all the etiologies, more than 600 cases, and these are allergists, they're very exacting, food, 22, medicine, 11, and exercise, 5, in 40%+ they couldn't determine an etiology. So yes, food allergies, bees, stings, exercise, drugs, yes. But be aware, you may not find the cause. As far as kids, I want to make one point. Be suspicious of new wheezing. You could say they have otitis and asthma. Anaphylaxis may present. The food allergy may present with just isolated wheezing. Ask some questions. Okay, there are five causes, five steps, five reasons. A sick patient presents, begin. It's the opening gambit. O2, O2, SAT, IV, access, ECG, and consider a 12-lead. Every time, every patient. And so, obviously, in someone with an allergic reaction, you do the first four. If they get hypotensive, do the 12-lead. Teaching point number one to take home. The number one cause of death from anaphylaxis is the failure of the patient, the paramedic, the nurse, or the doctor to give epinephrine or to give it in a timely fashion. Epi is the treatment of choice. The dose of epinephrine in a normal-sized patient is 0.3 IM, 0.3 milligrams IM. And if you do that, you're going to save a life. Now, obviously, if they're a child, we peds dose it. If you don't do a lot of peds, don't memorize any dose. Memorize the 0.3 and then estimate what size child it is compared to a normal size adult. It's about a half the size, 0.15, about a quarter the size. Give a quarter of 0.3. But don't start doing real major calculations.
I like that simplified approach rather than trying to memorize these ridiculous numbers that I can never remember or look it up really fast. Corey says, look at the kid. Estimate as a percentage of the size of the adult. Give that amount. And this is just a beginning amount. This is where we start. This is IM. Now, I won't go into my spiel about giving drugs IV. Let's just let Corey talk about this and then we're going to have a discussion at a later time with some experts about if you've got an IV in, whether you go for IM or IV. Okay, later.
There are a lot of dosing errors with epi. So if you don't like to make dosing errors, then order it like this. 0.3 of 1 milligram in 1 cc, which is the new recommended way to say it. This is the treatment of anaphylaxis when they call. Oxygen and epi, the keys to treatment. Supplement it with an IV and some Benadryl. Almost all units carry it. And then you can reassess them for additional therapy. Here is our therapy. Epi, Benadryl, H2, steroids, volume. I joke about five causes, five steps, but they're truly five drugs. That's what I'm doing. I want to talk about this. The dose of epi is 0.3. Give it IM, give it quick, do it. It is clearly the drug of choice, and in good studies involving ER docs, family practice people, internists, some nurse practitioners, less than one out of two patients with acute systemic allergic reactions that satisfy the criteria for anaphylaxis get it. Do you all know the number one cause of death from anaphylaxis? Was that covered yet? It's us failing to give epi. There. You don't have to believe me, but you have to believe the literature because literature is always right. Please, it's a drug of choice. You see that? If you got to use that, you screwed up, man. Okay?
Well, like you, I have no idea what he's showing right now. I'm assuming it's something like a plastic tube. And if you've had to tube the patient, you've screwed up. So he is pounding this point, 0.3 epi IM. Why would I detract from that by my silly commentary?
So which is better, sub-Q or IM? Let me begin by saying the dose of epi is 0.3 IM. Which one do you think is better? That's why I'm teaching. All right, so I know a lot of you know this. When you compare sub-Q to IM, IM is better than sub-Q. If you compare deltoid to thigh, thigh is better, except if someone's having an allergic reaction, like on a plane or something, and you're a guy and it happens to be a woman and you're like lifting her skirt, people get the wrong impression. Just do the deltoid. It's so embarrassing. Like, I'm a doctor. I know what I'm doing. All right. I have to say that a lot, by the way. All right. So the cause of anaphylaxis is histamine. You got hypoglycemia, you give glucose. You got a narcotic overdose, you give Narcan. You got a histamine overdose, you give an antihistamine. And you shouldn't do that. Antihistamines are a supplement. The treatment of anaphylaxis is epi. Antihistamines will work in the next 30 to 45 minutes. Antihistamines will block subsequent release. Antihistamines won't do dick for what's sitting on the receptor, epinephrine. And in this most excellent study, this is a Cochrane review, and the Canadians, God bless their souls, I know I shouldn't be anti any nationality. I hate the Canadians. I do. No, I do. I apologize. They sneak into our country and they look like Americans. Have you been to Canada? They have no guns and they clean up trash on their streets. What kind of country is that? If you want to settle a fight American way, you shoot somebody. I apologize. I hope this is not taped. I guess I'm supposed to say some of my best friends are Canadian, but they're not. All right. My mother was Canadian, so I could get out of it. I wish I had one of her passports. However, all the Cochrane things, they get two reviewers, they're drunk on Molson's and they write it up and they say, oh, it's a Cochrane review. But anyway, look what they found. And these were done by sober Canadians. There are no controlled studies to prove the efficacy of antihistamines in anaphylaxis. Not one. They didn't say a few, just a few, small numbers. There's no controlled studies. Epinephrine, you can supplement it with antihistamine. And you should add an H2 blocker. They're cheap, they last forever, and H2 blockers block bradykinin. Bradykinin is that thing that causes angioedema. Bradykinin is the thing that makes you vomit with anaphylaxis. Bradykinin causes urticaria. No side effects, really cheap, and you can charge patients a lot of money for it. No, there's some drugs out there that are just, you've got to use them. Aspirin. There are many states you can buy aspirin over the counter. You come to the ED, we'll charge you $8 to $20 for the aspirin. This is another one. H2 blockers, you can buy like a whole bottle of them. We charge you $40, but this is good. I'm on salary. All right. Steroids, love the steroids, but please remember, they're going to take hours to work. 3 days worth of steroids. The beauty of steroids are they block the inflammatory response. They make sure that you're not going to have a second wave of anaphylaxis, which occurs 4 to 8 hours later in somewhere around 5 or 6% of patients. That's also the beauty of repeating the antihistamine, of repeating the H2 blocker. Because 1 in 20 have a major second wave response from leukotrienes, if someone scares you so that while you're treating them, you're thinking, should I be standing on chucks? If someone scares you with anaphylaxis, don't get mad, get even. Make them stay with you for 8 to 12 hours or longer. The older they are and the sicker they got, that's what an OBS area is for. A 21-year-old comes in with chest pain. We might keep them for 2 or 3 days and do 4 MIBIs on. An older person comes in with anaphylaxis, they're out. Just reevaluate what you're thinking about. Be careful. As far as volume, I didn't appreciate how important volume was until a couple of reports came out. Tank people up. Anaphylaxis is a vasodilatory state. Volume is good. There are only 5 reversible causes of EMD-PEA. In anaphylaxis, you see where it says hypovolemia? It says go into the bathroom. There have been a number of case reports of people that were stabilized with epi, volume, etc., and either sat up or went to get up to go to the bathroom that either had syncope or cardiac arrests. It's because they were vasodilated. Keep people flatter longer. Give people more rather than less volume. All right, let's do a couple of cases real quick. Patient is eating pad thai, suddenly slumps in his noodles. His blood pressure is non-palpable. He's diaphoretic. He had med alert bracelet, says he's allergic to peanuts. You cannot feel a pulse. He's breathing and wheezing. What do you think? Oh, absolutely, it's anaphylaxis. might have been good Pad Thai, but this is great anaphylaxis. Treatment of anaphylaxis is? Dose? 0.3 IM. But the problem is, if someone has a non-palpable blood pressure, the 0.3 IM is going to last a lifetime. So, I want to go over next major teaching point. If you don't give intravenous epinephrine very often, and you're going to have to look it up, or you're going to have to order it from the pharmacy, your patient's going to do poorly. I want to teach you an idiot's way, and I mean me, not you, of being an absolute expert in front of a couple hundred people on the dosing of epi. I know how to give it in micrograms. The dose of epi to start in child or adult is 1 mic per minute. Now, I don't really know what a microgram is. I don't believe in the metric system, but I want to tell you how to mix it up. I had to watch Pulp Fiction about 5 times. I never understood Le Big Mac versus the Quarter Pounder. I couldn't figure it out. Anyway, it's the Royale with cheese, by the way. All right. If you have someone in true anaphylactic shock, hypotensive, you start an epi drip. Not you push in cardiac epi slowly. That's how you kill people. You start an epi drip, and this is how to do it. Take 1 milligram of epi and put it in 1 liter and start it at 1 cc a minute. 1 milligram, 1 liter, 1 cc. Piggyback it into a high-flow IV, and you are cooking. Milligram into a liter, drip slowly into the high-flow IV that's a river, and it takes it in there, and titrate to effect Q1 minute. At 1 or 2 mics, at 1, 2, or 3 minutes, your patient will be cured, and you will not kill them. If you want to screw up, if you want to be an amateur, do mini pushes of epi. You want to be one of the pros from Dover, drip. And the way I think the drip should be done is easy so that we can remember it. 1 milligram in 1 liter at a cc a minute into a high-flow IV. Titrate to effect. Next patient.
Well, I do have to intervene just a little bit here, and I have to go over the ACLS guidelines because you're all learning ACLS, and ACLS actually suggests something that Corey said you shouldn't do, and in fact, I have also suggested this same thing. But let's be quiet for a moment. Let's go back and just summarize what Corey has said. If you've got somebody who has anaphylaxis, you're going to give them epinephrine. That's the treatment. You're going to give these other supplemental drugs. That's fine. If they've had bad anaphylaxis, you need to keep them. You need to keep them because 1 in 20 are going to have a second phase of this, and so you should watch them for the magic 8 to 12 hours. If you want to go to an epi drip, they've truly got anaphylaxis, if they've got ongoing symptoms in particular, then you're going to have to do an epi drip. I suggest that if you have a pharmacist, they set it up for you, that you have the nurses set it up for you. You start at 1 mic per minute. 1 mic per minute. He's suggesting that if you don't have that, you take 1 milligram of epinephrine, so that's 1 mil of 1 in 10,000, put it into a bag of saline, and then run it at 1 mil per minute. That makes a lot of sense to me. He says, do not do this. He says, do not use the crash cart epi, the 1 in 10,000, and give 0.1 milligrams IV slowly over 5 minutes. But of course, that is what ACLS says to do. They say give 0.1 milligrams IV slowly over 5 minutes if you're in the pooper. So that would be 1 mil of 1 in 10,000 epinephrine over 5 minutes. Sitting there and pushing 1 mil over 5 minutes, very difficult. So people do it different ways. They take that 1 mil, they shove it into a 100 mil bag of saline, and they run it over 5 minutes, that kind of thing. But this is Corey's show, not mine. If you go to MRAP TV, I did a thing on epinephrine and how to mix it up a few years ago, and I did it wrong. And there is a new one going up soon. By the time you get this, in fact, by the time you get this, there will be a new MRAP TV up with the different ways of giving epinephrine in anaphylaxis. Corey is a master of education. His job, in his eyes, is to keep it simple. Because if we keep it simple, we reduce substantially the chance that we are going to screw up. I have great fear and loathing telling you any different than what this man is telling you, because he is the legend. And as soon as we start to complicate it, we get confused. So keep it simple if you want. I think that's appropriate. 0.3 mils of 1 in 10,000 IM is the treatment of anaphylaxis. Watch them for a while. Give them the other supplemental drugs. If you're going to give it IV, 1 milligram in 1 liter of saline, run at 1 mic per minute. That is Corey Slovis. He is the man.
61-year-old man, history of shellfish allergy, has soup with fish stock, begins wheezing, says his throat's closing up. EMS gets there. He's an older patient. Epi is not indicated in older people, and they're wise, and they give only 0.2 rather than 0.3. He gets Benadryl. They start a large bore IV. He comes into the ED. He has dyspnea. His O2 sats are falling. His wheezing is worse. But his blood pressure has gone up from 90 over 60 to 160 over 100. How would you treat him? More epi drip. That blood pressure, he's hypertensive now. So just two quick tricks. Glucagon in people that are on beta blockers has been shown to work. There are a huge number of papers, only two that have really studied it. But be aware, in beta blocker patients where epi has been refractory, where not that many cases, glucagon. And just go ahead and titrate up the glucagon, one or two, go up to 5 or 10, be prepared for vomiting, better than dying. And then the other thing is vasopressin has been reported also. Start low, 2, then 5, then 10. This 2 has been reported to be effective, especially in people on beta blockers. Epi 0.3, a milligram in a liter at 1 cc a minute. Be aware that glucagon has been used, so is vasopressin. If you read one and only one article, 3-page article, you will have read the single best article. You're an absolute expert in 3 pages. This comes from the Southern Medical Journal, former president of the American Association of Allergy and Immunology. I've tried to cover these points. He makes them a lot better. Progression to death, this is all about anaphylaxis. Progression from death is unpredictable. Treat patients as soon as symptoms occur. Anaphylaxis can present as isolated hypotension. Epinephrine is the drug of choice. Antihistamines and steroids are second line. Give epi IM, not sub-Q. IV epi should only be used in dire straits and never at less than 1 to 10,000 dilution. There's no absolute contraindication epi. The dose is 0.3 IM, and you make it lower for little kids. You could give 0.15 to someone with heart disease, and you could always repeat it. Anaphylaxis is biphasic in up to 20% of cases. Prescribe an EpiPen for home use. 40% of patients that are re-stung by an insect will have an equally severe or worse response. Refer them for mandatory immunotherapy if they get it from a sting. Last 3, beware of vomiting when you give glucagon. Anaphylaxis can last a lot of hours, and most physicians do not know how to use or teach the use of an EpiPen. Be sure when your patient leaves with a prescription for an EpiPen, you, the nurse, or somebody has shown them how to use it. It's kind of like on the internet, the patient comes in using the bronchodilator and it's not working, and the video shows she's spraying her neck. So just make sure they know how to use the EpiPen. I'm not going to talk about angioedema, but be aware that epi is not indicated, and be aware that fresh frozen plasma in angioedema that has not responded to H1 and H2 blockers is something to consider. All right, the next thing I want to talk about is heart failure. I know you know a lot about heart failure, and this is risky right before lunch. I just want to make a couple of points. And so the first point is be careful in the diagnosis of heart failure. Sometimes we under and overcall it. If you have someone with heart disease and lung disease, rather than spending time on deciding which one it is, I would flip a coin. Because at least you're doing an objective test. If you think that that's heresy, then do a B natriuretic peptide, but don't just depend on the x-ray. Don't just depend on your clinical judgment. Although it's good, be aware that in really good studies, some more than 10 years old, some almost 20 years old, Rales edema and increased jugular venous distension, 4 out of 10 patients didn't have it who had wedge pressures. These people were swanned, had wedges over 30. Chronic heart failure may allow the x-ray to normalize some. It's not like florid pulmonary edema. Be aware that the x-ray is not a good predictor. Be careful. In an outstanding study done with pulmonologists and cardiologists, they were wrong about 1 in 5 times. Each one of them, wrong 1 out of 5 times. It's core reading. This is from LLSA. This is a great article. It talks about what really works. More than 5,000 patients included. And when you look at the objective data, our clinical gestalt's pretty good. Most of us don't do JVD stuff anymore. I don't even know where it's located. I thought it was periumbilical, and my resident said, no, you're a little low. But it's somewhere in the neck, and it's some reflex. But our physical diagnostic abilities continue to decline. Be careful. I could diagnose that. That's heart failure, by the way. I like to show I can read an x-ray. These are the 5 things to make you say, I don't think this is heart failure. They don't have a history of previous episodes of congestive heart failure. They don't have dyspnea on exertion. They don't have rails. They have a normal heart size. They have a normal EKG, because a lot of people with heart failure are going to have LVH, they're going to have atrial fib, they're going to have atrial strain and ventricular strain patterns. The best single test, get the damn BNP. I'm not opposed to BNPs, but get a BNP too. I've never seen a patient in the ER that couldn't get one more blood test. This is a time to get one. All right, so I didn't know I was giving this talk now, so I'm going to do the 2008 treatment of heart failure. You don't need the 2010. Nothing much has changed. All right, so ABCs, NGT, begin bronchodilators, morphine if they have bad heart failure, and administer Lasix. That's quality heart failure care. And some people treat it like that. So let me talk about heart failure. Number one, anaphylaxis equals epi. Heart failure equals nitroglycerin. The treatment of choice of anaphylaxis, epi. The treatment of choice of heart failure, nitroglycerin. We're going to talk about Lasix in a minute. I'm aware from really good embryologic studies that there is a small part in our brain where we hear dyspnea. There is a Lasix reflex. I understand, you know, when you can follow family lines, it's like prolonged QT. People have it. But please be aware, you got to suppress. I'm taking anti-Lasix drug right now. Anyway, did you think I was getting fat? Anyway, nitroglycerin decreases preload, afterload, decreases the work of the heart, decreases O2 consumption. You got to love it. Now, nisiratide is as good as nitroglycerin, but it costs $3,000. Nitroglycerin is essentially free. The only advantage nitroglycerin has over nisiratide is it doesn't kill people with renal failure. My bias is nitroglycerin. I am not sponsored by nisiratide. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It is an expensive drug, and you ought to think about it. Anyway, don't let people get too hypotensive. And a common mistake, I'm turning off the ACT for a second. In people with angina, you titrate up the nitroglycerin until the pain goes away. And we see a lot of people with angina. We don't see that many people with pulmonary edema. It's the opposite in pulmonary edema. Don't stop the nitroglycerin if they start to pee or they feel a little bit better. Titrate it up so that you can move into the 40, 50, 60 range. If they start getting a headache, back off. If they start getting hypotensive or tachycardic, back off. But you want to be aggressive with nitroglycerin. You want to maximize the diuresis. You want to maximize the unloading. You want to maximize getting them back on the Starling curve. I used to think bronchodilators were the thing to give. Be aware that in 2008 it was, but not in 2010. Although it decreases VQ mismatch and it helps in wheezing patients, when it was looked at in the ADHERE registry, which is retrospective, what they found was that if you had no history of COPD or no wheezing, you did worse with bronchodilators. If they ain't wheezing, if there's not a chance at COPD, do not give bronchodilators. They don't change mortality, but it increased the need to be intubated. It increased the need for the patient to move rapidly to the critical care unit and get IV vasodilators. So bronchodilators, they're wheezing or they have COPD. No wheeze, no COPD, don't use it. Now, morphine is another drug that some of us continue to use. I want to try to review in the time remaining the world's literature on it. It's a weak vasodilator. It calms the patient. It's been used for almost 100 years. It may improve diaphragmatic contractility. And you don't want to titrate it up. Give 1 or 2 milligrams. When you look at morphine, though, morphine ain't that great. This is from the CRUSADE database. This is retrospective data. This is on non-STEMI patients. And morphine increased mortality. It increased MIs. Now, this is retrospective, and this is MI stuff, so you don't want to see that. I showed it anyway. Now, I want to do acute heart failure. Okay, this is from the ADHERE registry. These are patients from the registry, retrospective. 14.1% of them received morphine for their congestive heart failure. Now called heart failure. The C is gone. I don't know what happened to it. So here are the people, and it's divided into two groups. Number one, all comers. But one of the potential limitations of the study is morphine might be used pre-intubation. So they said no. If morphine was it used therapeutically, not in people going on to mechanical ventilation? And take a look what happens. If you look at all comers, you use morphine in heart failure, mortality goes way up. Even if you look at people that weren't getting some morphine, getting ready to be intubated electively or semi-electively, there is no role for morphine in heart failure. There is no data on it. There is not one study. Not one. Don't use it.
We'll talk more about that on MRAP in coming months.
Next drug is Lasix. Lasix is a diuretic. But be aware, if you give Lasix immediately to someone with heart failure, you run two risks. Number one, they didn't need it. Number two, Lasix without nitroglycerin or another vasodilator on board is a vasoconstrictor. It elevates wedge pressure 2 to 3 millimeters. It makes the patient acutely worse. Here's an article from Jerry Hoffman years ago. Morphine and Lasix, potentially dangerous. Nitroglycerin, beneficial. Here's another study. Preload, Lasix. There are three studies. They appear about once every 10 years to reinforce the same concept. Lasix elevates preload. Lasix makes people worse. The other thing is a lot of people that get Lasix don't even need it. My recommendation is to wait for nitroglycerin to work. Wait until diagnosis is a certainty. Don't use it early. Be careful. You got somebody who has COPD, wheezing, decompensated. You give them Lasix, they're going down. Is there something better than Lasix? Of course. There has to be. If it's on the slide, it's a question. You know it's setting me up. And that is CPAP or BiPAP. These are wonderful things in the emergency department and now on many EMS units. It recruits alveoli. It really improves patients' oxygenation. Once the panic is over, they feel better. Some patients call and request it. And it's been shown to decrease the need to intubate, and it has been shown to decrease mortality. This is the largest single trial, a meta-analysis, decreased mortality by almost 50%, decreased need to intubate by 60%. This is a scientific talk. Every scientific talk should have one or two black and white slides, which are totally unreadable. This is the first. That is the second. I have done my job on your evaluation. There's a little box that says, did he show some crap you couldn't read? Those are the two slides. All right, so that's heart failure 2008. That's heart failure 2010. Oxygen, nitrates, titrated up aggressively. Beta agonist, only if wheezing. Lasix, only after you got the nitroglycerin going and you're sure of the diagnosis and the person needs a little extra zets. And then finally, you don't have to intubate them. Try BiPAP or CPAP unless they have altered mental status or they're really hypoxic and in extremis. All right, we're rolling. I want to just do a little bit on asthma and let's get out of here. There are all these asthma severity scores and stuff. I think the single best thing, now respiratory therapy is going to do an FEV1 and you're going to have one first-year resident that's going to show you some amazing score and an intercept. Talk to the patient. If they can't talk in full sentences, they got severe asthma. If they can only talk in words, they're about to arrest, you better do something. And this is from the NIH. I didn't make these numbers up or that chart up. This is really good stuff. It allows you very quickly to assess where they are. They're having trouble talking in full sentences, you have severe asthma. They're giving you one or two words and they're giving you the big look. Don't say, well, let's get an FEV1. You can do it on yourself, but not on the patient. There are five causes, five steps, five reasons. By law, by convention, there have to be five therapies for asthma. And all kidding aside, although I would have thrown in some therapies just so I had five, when someone with severe asthma comes in, this is what I do, every patient. Immediately start oxygen, and with the oxygen, they get continuous beta agonist and anticholinergic. They have severe asthma, they're getting steroids. Anyone that comes to the ED just about ought to get steroids for asthma. And remember that steroids, although they don't work immediately, they within 30 to 60 minutes have a local effect and they sensitize the beta receptors so that your bronchodilators will work better. And then in severe asthma, use some magnesium. The key on magnesium, God's fluid, is that magnesium works the best in the most severe patients. Magnesium works the best in the worst patients. It's only in the 10 to 20% of really severe asthmatics that you can show magnesium has a benefit, but those are the very people you want to be sure you use it in. So severe asthma, O2, beta agonist, anticholinergic, steroids, magnesium. The things I talk about, although I have my own personal biases, please be aware that there is a definitive document, and that comes from the National Heart and Lung and Blood Institute, NHLBI, and it's the expert panel on the management of asthma. This is the current state-of-the-art management. Beta agonist, of course, recommended. And it turns out continuous is easier unless you have just the most mild asthmatic. My bias is just put them all on continuous. We use both a beta agonist and an anticholinergic. And the reason we do is there's no data to say acutely anticholinergics are bad. And in 10 to 20% of asthmatics, they get 10 to 20% bump in FEV1. Most asthmatics do not benefit. None of them get hurt by it. As far as levalbuterol, there are some COPDers that are more sensitive to the beta agonists. Otherwise, there's not good data on improved efficacy. Anticholinergics, my bias is to always use them. The less I think, the better I can do. So I don't think at all when I work. I do a great job. The first part is true. The second, not so much. Steroids, use them. And I've told you about magnesium. It works in kids. I'm not sure the right dose of magnesium, and I would defer to my pediatric colleagues. In one study that we did, rather than 50, we found that doses at 100 to 150 milligrams per kilo were better. Be aggressive with magnesium. Kids tolerate it. It is a benign drug. Don't give it IV push. So epinephrine, love the drug. When I trained a long time ago in a place far, far away, and a long time ago enough that some of the younger members of this group were not yet born, we had two drugs. We had epi and we had aminophylline. This is not an aminophylline talk. But the dose of epi was 0.3 sub-Q every 10 minutes for three doses unless the patient improved. Epi was given to every asthmatic. Epi is a spectacular drug. There is no study to show that beta agonists are better than epi, just they're less toxic. So your sixth drug in someone getting not well, someone getting worse, give them some IM, or my bias here is sub-Q. It works a little bit slower, but either one. Epi is a great drug. Epi is a great drug. Never in COPD, never in heart failure, but in asthma, giddy up. 23-year-old asthmatic, O2 sat 89%, 10 minutes of continuous nebs, 2 grams of mag, 0.3 of epi. She's getting worse. She's getting anxious. You could intubate her. But be aware that you can also do intravenous epinephrine. How do you dose epinephrine in asthma if you're going to give it IV? Anyone know any tricks on that? Oh, yeah. 1 milligram, 1 liter, 1 cc a minute. I am telling you, this empowers you to use an intravenous drug safely. This is not mini push epi. This is not, I'm going to dilute it 1 to 100,000. Do I have the dose right? A milligram in a liter, 1 cc a minute, piggyback it in, and in 1, 2, or 5 minutes, you know whether you're going to intubate or you just saved an intubation. It is outstanding. It is life-saving. It is a great thing to do. All right, I want to make a couple of just clinical pearls out of this, and we're stopping. Intubation should be performed by the physician who has the most extensive experience in intubation and airway management. If you have to intubate an asthmatic, get everything ready, get the room calm, and the single bestest person that's readily available needs to do it. If it's you, great. If it's your partner, great. If it's calling anesthesia, great. But this is not the time to do the intubation when you haven't done one in a while, or you're not at the top of your game, or somebody else better can be there quick. You want to hit this first time. And Jeff Hayden is going to give, I'm sure, an outstanding talk on whether the laryngoscope is obsolete. I think it is. I want to tell you that when Ron Wall said it was a number of years ago at our Grand Rounds, but please take a look at the new devices out there. My personal bias is the Storz video laryngoscope. I'm not getting paid by any company. If I was, I would tell you and I'd be rich. But I've intubated for a long time. But using the same kind of thing as I used before, but rather than using a Mach 3 or a Mach 4, now I have a really high intensity light. And if I can't see everything, the television screen has even a better view because it's mounted where the light is. Don't rely on 1940s technology. Move into the year 2010 or at least 2008 when this came out. Take a look at them. Some of you may like the GlideScope. It takes a little bit additional skill. Be sure you have a bougie on board. Be sure you have a really small tube as an extra. Be sure you have backup everything. And you don't have to do real RSI. This is another recommendation. Consider semi-awake intubations. I know the dose of etomidate, 20. Don't use it. No. I know if they're bigger, you could use more. I know the dose is 0.3. Don't do that. Think about like 5 milligrams or a propofol titration or a ketamine so that the person still is moving air. Keep an oxygen tube in their mouth, and if you can see the cords, pass the tube and dive them. If you can't, at least you can still ventilate them. But if you crash them and can't intubate them, you're shit out of luck. Passive or permissive hypercapnia is what you want. People don't die of a CO2 of 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, or 100. But they do die of an O2 sat of 10, 20, or 30. Ventilate them slowly, prolonged expiratory phase. Number one cause of tension pneumothorax, barotrauma. You want to get barotrauma? take a really tight asthmatic that you had to intubate and pump them up. They all explode. They fly all around the room and then they crash and die. I'm making a joke, but we shouldn't let asthmatics die. There are different. Ventilate them slowly. It's the oxygen, not the ventilation and CO2. Go slow. Earlier, I think Amal was talking about it. Low tidal volumes. This has been shown even in non-asthmatics. Think about 5 or 6 cc's per kilo, not 8 to 12 or 8 to 15.
You know, this is not fair because asthma is a giant topic we need to cover in a lot of detail. Let's go over the summary. We're going to get back to asthma in the next few months, in fact, and go into this in much more detail. And we're going to try and get Corey on the phone and get his input on that lecture. So give lots of albuterol. We like that. If they're getting worse, give epinephrine. He talked about giving it subcutaneously. My bias is to give it IV. If you're going to give it IV, do an epi drip if possible. And don't even do the simplified way. Have somebody else set it up. Have your nurses set it up. There are protocols that they follow. They're more anal retentive. They are safer than us. But if you need to, Corey's way of doing this is 1 mil of 1 in 1,000, so 1 milligram or 1,000 micrograms in a liter of saline, run at 1 mL/min, giving you 1 mic/min drip. And you can titrate it up and titrate it down. That's his simplified approach. We're going to talk much more about this, much, much more about this in coming months, because we really want to do this topic to death. We want to go over asthma again. It's been a few years since we've done it in real detail, and we are actually going to get a host of experts in this area to talk about the subtleties of management of asthma. It's important.
I'm going to make 3 words about COPD. Number one, magnesium, love it. CPAP, BiPAP, love it. Number two, never use epi in COPD. That's the shortest COPD talk I've ever given. Magnesium is outstanding. Anticholinergics, outstanding. CPAP and BiPAP, outstanding. Epinephrine, not so much. Let me summarize. Number one, I know that there are many times there are more than 5 steps or just 2. But the joke about 5 causes, 5 steps, when we're dealing in emergencies, our brains sometimes don't work as well as we'd like them to. So try to simplify your protocols. Don't have like a 19-step ACLS algorithm. 3, 4, or 5 steps is the most we can remember. There are 5 causes of wheezing. Please remember that heart failure and pulmonary embolus can present as wheezing. Obviously, you're going to get a chest x-ray and wheezing of unknown cause. Look for subtle findings. All that wheezes is not asthma. Beware heart failure. It is the great imitator. The dose of epi is 0.3 IM for normal-sized people. Memorize any dose you want for kids. But if you can't remember what that dose is, this is not exact science. Just what size were they compared to a normal adult? That's how much I gave. The treatment of heart failure is nitroglycerin. It is not Lasix. The treatment of heart failure is nitroglycerin, not Lasix. BiPAP and CPAP are your friends. Bronchodilators are good, but only if they're wheezing, and especially only if they're wheezing with heart failure. Magnesium works the best in the worst patients. If they can't talk in full sentences, you're dealing with big trouble. Our job is to secure the ABCs. It has been my privilege. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, he's Corey Slovis. I'm certainly not worthy. We are going to talk a lot more about some of the issues he's raised in coming months. Thank you, Mr. Slovis. You're a good man.